So I'm going to talk about fluctuation effects of Monte Coulomb fluids. And this is work that I did with John Morgan and Daniel Sontanac. In fact, it was published in 1998, and it's in JSTAT Journal. And actually, the reason I'm going to talk about it is that we've been extending, because in the initial paper, when you talk to people, there are lots of questions that emerge, and I think there are lots of other things I could talk about. So now, actually, we're working on this. We're looking at a slightly different problem with Ali and with Rudy, using this approach. So basically, what I'm going to talk about is, what can you learn about fluctuation-induced interactions in electrostatic systems, but looking at exactly soluble models, okay? So the physics isn't perhaps the physics you want to solve, but at least it has the virtue of everything being under control mathematically. Okay, so the physical system that I'll be interested in here is something basically you can think of as a soap film. So what I'm going to have is I have a surface here, and the soap film surface, it's a bit like an inverted cell membrane. Of course, it's much more, pays better to talk about cell membranes than soap films these days. So in a soap film, basically, you have air here. You have your electrolyte solution here. And here you have a region, the surface of the soap film is made up of hydrophobic tails. And just in contact with the water layer here is you have hydrophilic. So the sort of soap you might use is something like sodium SDS, sodium dihydroxyl sulfate, I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly, or AOT. And actually normally what you have in these soap films, and what happens in sort of these are a bit like lipids that occur in biological membranes as well, often they have a charge. Okay? So the interesting thing is, what is the interaction between these two surfaces, given that you've got counter ions, for example, floating around in your system? So you've got some sort of distance here, L, and there'll be an effective interaction, which is called the disjoint pressure in the right ensemble. And you want to be able to understand the physics of this interaction. So typically in soap film experiments, the experiments that were carried out in Saclay, use something like SDS, just to give you an idea of the scales here, you have this hydrophilic head region, which is about 4 angstroms thick. This tail region is about 10 angstroms. And you can vary this distance here. Okay? And of course, so basically, the reason that this negative charge goes onto the surface and wants to stay on the surface and is not attracted back into the system is due to this hydrophobic energy. You see, if I put these hydrocarbon tails inside the liquid, inside the water, it basically, the hydrogen bonding doesn't like the water, has difficulty hydrogen bonding. And basically, there's a sort of free energy price that you pay for putting one of these soap molecules purely into the solution. It's basically equal to W times the area of the molecule, the rough estimate. And this energy per unit length here is about 40 millijoules per meter squared. Okay. So the sorts of experiments you can do, they're nice experiments. Basically what you have is, the measurements that are made are made using X-ray reflectivity, which basically gives you an access to that by looking at the contrast in electronic density, it gives you access to basically the electronic density and the width of each of these regions, okay? And the experimental setup, because it's important to get the modeling, to get the physics right, is that I have a pressure cell, and inside here I have my soap film is suspended in a porous frit, which acts as a bulk reservoir. Okay, so I have the surface here, but I have a mixture of soap and electrolyte that can basically flow into the film. And what I have here as well, I have a small tube coming out here, which is actually connected with the bulk. And what I can do is I can apply a pressure here, and I can look at the difference between the pressure I apply and the pressure that's here, and that gives me a direct measure of the interaction across the soap film. And that's called the disjoining pressure, PD, is basically equal to the pressure of the film minus the pressure of the bulk. Okay? So when I squeeze my system, charges can leave and enter. Okay, so this is the quantity that we'll be interested in. Okay? And so the ensemble for this calculation is the Grand Canonical Ensemble. Okay. Now the interesting thing is, if you look at the experimental results, if you plot the disjoining pressure as a function of the separation between the two soap film surfaces, and it's the width of the water region, basically what happens is you have PD here, you have your L here, and so this typical scale here is the order of 100 angstroms, okay, for a common Newton black film. And basically, as you applying pressure, basically what you find is, let me just draw this first. So this is what the theorists would want. And what basically happens, if I look at the experimental points, they do something like this. And then, of course, this region is unstable, and there's a sort of jump to a very thin region. And the thickness of this film is about 5 angstroms. And this is called the Newton black film, and it's blackness of its optical properties. So thin. Okay? And basically, the structure of that sort of film, I mean, it's almost, you know, there are basically three. The two surfaces are very close to each other, and you've got basically, you know, 5 angstroms between them. So there are only, you know, molecular sizes. You've typically got 3 or 4 molecules in the system, or ions in the system in between. So the question is, so basically now this SDS, it has a surface charge, okay? So the point is, it's normal that we're going to find some sort of repulsion, because everybody believes that light-charged surfaces repel each other, okay? But there is this transition here. So at a certain moment, there's an effective, attractive interaction which is coming into play. Now, we think about so we have this non-monotonic behavior of the disjoining pressure. We'd like to understand it. So we could ask ourselves about the questions. So if you just think about, obviously this film here is stable, essentially, is stabilized here essentially by steric forces. Things are so close to each other, the actual molecular structure.
Absolutely trivial question. The little arrow that you have going in the box there is the pressure on the film.
I have a thing that I can pump air into here.
Right, and you're calling that the P film.
That's right.
Yeah. Squeeze the juice out of the system, basically.
That's right. Yeah.
But it's going to help you sometimes.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah.
So you're going to tell us why it's hard and then easy.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I'm. Yes, that would be okay. Ideal. Okay, so why is it hard and then is it easy? Okay, so the forces that are present is you have the electrostatic forces. And when I talk about electrostatic forces, I'm not just going to talk about mean field forces, I'm going to talk about the whole theory of electrostatic forces. And if we're talking about van der Waals forces, these are sort of coupled, you know, the sort of omega equals zero or thermal Casimir type van der Waals forces here as well, okay? So this is plus thermal. And this because basically what happens is that it's very easy to see, is that the thermal part of the Casimir force is coupled. I mean, it's the zero frequency van der Waals interactions. So, and that's coupled to the ionic distribution. And then you would have sort of the van der Waals forces omega not equal to zero, okay, and you assume that because the ions won't respond quickly enough to the fluctuation, that they're decoupled. So the question is, so our thermal Casimir forces are coupled to the ionic distribution, but the van der Waals forces at non-zero frequency aren't. Now, if you want to compute these objects here, it's pretty complicated. You have to know about the dielectric properties of this three-layer system, okay, and various experimental groups have different approximations, different ways of calculating this. But what these forces will give you is an attractive interaction. Okay, they'll be attractive if you're in a regime where the retardation effects aren't important. Okay, so you do expect some sort of attractive interaction. But if you look at the mean field theory, the Poisson-Boltzmann theory for these systems, they give you That gives you repulsion, always gives you repulsion. Mean field theory, as long as these two charged surfaces are more or less symmetrical. Now, in the way in which the experiments were analyzed in Saclay, it suggested that the zero frequency, the non-zero frequency van der Waals forces, plus mean field theory, and even a mean field theory that we developed in order to take into account charge regulation on the surface, didn't explain this collapse in quite the right place. It happened at shorter distances, and so we were somehow missing a force, and sort of in the literature, this missing force, now perhaps this force isn't missing, perhaps it's just because of incomplete knowledge due to the van der Waals, perhaps not calculating these interactions correctly. But it's clear as well that the mean field contribution to the mean field electrostatic contribution is probably overestimating the repulsion. And actually, Rudy was one of the first people to look at the fluctuations about mean field, and what that tends to do is generically give you an additional attractive force, okay?
Maybe I misunderstood. At the mean field level, what is repelling what here? The system is completely neutral, isn't it?
Yes, the system is completely neutral, yeah.
So, where is the repulsion?
Well, that's a good question. Basically, what happens... Actually, if you look, you can say that these two surfaces, because they're negatively charged, even though they have some sort of screens Coulomb interaction between them, okay?
And the positive charge is probably in between or somewhere.
Yes. Yeah, well, you have a mixture of charges. But basically what happens is, if you look at the theory, the film wants to... You have counter-ions that will come in and decide to neutralize the surface. So you say, yeah, why is... But actually what happens is, you pay a big energetic price for the system not being electroneutral. So basically what happens is that ions come in from the bulk, okay? And these ions, even though they've come into, they basically increase the density here. And at the mean field level, what you can show is that the pressure is proportional to the density here minus the density of the bulk, okay? And it's because these ions come in that actually, it's a good question, because the mechanism isn't as clear cut as a simple interaction across two screen surfaces. And in fact, I think if you look at this calculation and you're not careful, you might even get the effective screening wrong by a factor of a half, no? Because it'll give you e to the 2 ml and not e to the minus ml, where m is the Debye screening length. So this is really, though,
you get the sign wrong.
Right. Yes, well, the sign wrong, yes. We would like to get the sign wrong. At least the, yes. Okay.
So basically, you do this at the range of for different salts and different concentrations of salts, and you're showing us for one representative. Presumably, if you change the concentration of salts,
yeah, you can shift these. You can shift these curves around. Yeah.
But still, this behavior remains.
Yeah. This is sort of generic sort of.
And even in the limit of zero salt concentration.
Well, actually, no. Actually, there is always some bulk, because there's a problem stabilizing the films if you don't have any salt in them. Okay, so there's stabilization questions. So in fact, when we were analyzing the data, actually, what we actually found was that the van der Waals forces, the non-zero van der Waals forces, were actually more important to stabilize the film at very long distances, because the electrostatic interaction is effectively screened. Okay, so the question is now, So if I just think about the electrostatic problem, I forget the van der Waals forces, is it possible to have a mechanism whereby this sort of thing occurs, that the interaction effectively changes sign? Okay? Now, calculations about, the corrections about mean field theory certainly suggest that this can give you interaction, attraction. So let me just explain the field theory that you... Because you can get something that you will recognize, okay? So Z, the partition function of the system, is basically I have to take the trace over all my particle positions in my problem, and I'm gonna write d phi, okay? Exponential of minus beta epsilon, so beta over 2, and I'm just looking at electrostatics. But I can have a varying dielectric constant, so I'm gonna put this term in here, and in principle, this field is now coupled to the electronic density, which couples to field phi. And this phi is actually, when you do the Wick rotation, basically corresponds to minus the physical electrostatic potential. And if you can even put dipoles in the model, and then in which case you get something like a dipole field, you get something like this, okay? And you can have additional interactions. So you could have, say, you could imagine that you want to, imagine you wanted to put one of your species on the surface for thermodynamic reasons. You could put a potential in here, you know, sort of Vi of X, which would act on the density. Okay, so this would be like an external potential. So essentially you get this sort of theory.
Just the epsilon of X is what again?
This is the static dielectric constant. This is the dielectric constant.
But what's the X going in there?
Oh, this is dx. Well, it can depend on space.
So spatially varying.
It can be spatially varying. Now, actually, the thing is, if epsilon doesn't depend on space, then, of course, this term, you know, because often when you look at statistical mechanics treatments of interacting particle systems, often, I think it's Polyakov was the first person to do it, you make a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation to decouple the particle interactions, and that gives you some effective field theory, for example, and you can trace over the particle positions. But often you say, well, actually, I should, when I do the functional integral, I'm introducing a debt to the minus a half, which I shouldn't have introduced. Often it's taken out. But here, actually, you know, this is the right thing, because this interaction here, when I do the Gaussian integral now, I really need this, because this is giving me zero frequency van der Waals interactions, and it's giving me image charges and everything. So, you know, all of the physics about image charges and thermal fluctuation forces is in this thing here. It's in the Lipschitz.
This is the electric constant must be some function of rho. What is the?
Well, yes. Okay. So now, in the simplest case of the primitive model, what you would do is you basically put this model here. You would say you would put water here. You would put the dielectric constant you would associate with these tails. So you have basically a number of regions. Now, it is true that if you're...
So it's just some kind of predefined function. It's not part of...
Yeah, well, basically, in this model here, as long as if I could ignore the dipole, the polarizability and any permanent dipole effects of my ions, I would say that the dielectric constant is basically given, at least at a certain scale, by the dielectric constant of water. But it's true. And in fact, you know, I think there are lots of interesting questions we could discuss later about how polarizability of charged particles changes the physics, okay? And that's sort of... That's an important, and then the dielectric constant will then vary in space. Will vary with the count of the ionic distribution. Okay. So if you look at this field theory, if you go to if I look at the simplest case, I go to the grand canonical ensemble. I introduce. Imagine I have two species, Na plus Cl minus. I say they both come from a bulk with the same chemical potential. I want my system to be electroneutral. I basically find, so if you want to, the electric field here, the physical electric field, phi is equal to I phi, which is the real electrostatic.
Okay. May I ask you, this is all completely classical, there is no quantum mechanics.
No, actually, I was a bit worried when I wrote one-dimensional Coulomb gas that lots of this kind of people would turn up and then be very, very angry with me. Yeah, no, this is the... Yeah, this is the field theory, this is called field theory. Okay? And so basically now what happens, if I decide to have... the nice thing about this is decoupled the interactions between the particles, at least the electrostatic interactions, so I can now average over the position of all my positive particles. So, for instance, one particle will give me a term like e to the I beta phi of x. I'll integrate it over the region of space where they're allowed to be. If I have n of them, I'll have a 1 over the positive ones, 1 over n plus factorial. I have an n plus here. And I'll have something similar for the negative particles, okay? The minus I beta phi, integrate over this region here, you see. If I go to the grand canonical ensemble and do the sum over these things, basically what happens is that this term here, so I'll ignore the dipoles for the moment, okay? This term here, now if each of these particles had an external potential V acting on them, okay, when I do this, because it was an external potential, I would have an additional term, something like e to the I beta V plus here, and an e to the minus I beta V minus, okay, so this is just the potential acting on any external potential I hope to apply. Now, in the case where V plus and V minus are zero, so they're coming in for the bulk, and you know, V plus could represent a preference for one of the species to go near the surface. Okay? But basically, what it gives you in your action, it gives you a term that looks like 2 mu away from the potential times the cosine of E beta phi. Okay? Now, if I do mean field theory on this, I have an action which looks like del grad phi squared plus a cosine. The mean field, and I do this Wick rotation, I basically find the Poisson-Boltzmann equation. Okay? So the action for this field theory, so if this theory has an action S, if I look at ds by d phi equals zero, and I then say phi is equal to I and psi, I find the Poisson-Boltzmann. Mean field theory. Okay? Okay, so that's the theory that you would like to look at. And as I was saying, I think maybe Rudy was one of the guys who sort of pioneered this functional integral approach. And so you work out basically what happens at your mean field theory level, and you can then look at the fluctuations. Now, looking at the fluctuations about, if you have a physical problem which actually means that you have a mean field surface charge being generated, okay, so this would be the case in my soap film, because there's a chemical potential which will prefer to put the soap on the surface. This also happens in things like bubbles. If you look at bubbles, if you have air-water interfaces, some ions, if they're hydrated, are effectively bigger, and they don't get as close to the surface as some other ions, okay? So you can have sort of a purely entropic generation of a surface charge. So I think if you look at bubbles in water, they have an effective negative charge on them.
It depends
on the salt, but they can have an effective negative charge on them. And if you screen this interaction, if there's no screening, then they will tend to repel each other. If you screen this interaction, your bubbles can get together. And if you read this, I was at this Barry Neenan comment that if you increase the salt concentration in your blood just a little bit more, it means that if you have any bubbles of nitrogen or oxygen that are created in your blood, rather than repelling each other, they will merge, and you know, you will not feel well. So this is nature's fine tuning. You need salt, but not too much salt, otherwise you have this problem with blood. Okay, so you have this field theory. Okay, so basically what happens is, generically for symmetrical systems, if you generate a surface charge, the mean field theory gives you a repulsion, and you can actually look at the fluctuations, and that they generically tend to give you an attraction. Now, looking at the fluctuations is actually quite difficult, because you will actually have a profile for your, you know, so if you look at the second derivative, you're going to get your cos e beta phi mean field, and you're going to get your fluctuation field multiplying this, okay? And this will typically depend on the z, the x direction in your field. So this is like a mass term in your field theory, but it will depend on its position. And there are ways that Rudy's worked on where you use, there are clever ways of working out this functional determinant when there's actually a z dependence in the mass. Okay, so what you can also do is if you look at, if you decide to have a system which has no charge whatsoever, then you do get an attractive interaction. And at the simplest level, it's just a Debye-Huckel theory. So you find that the disjoining pressure looks something like, if I use units of the Debye length, it looks like e to the minus 2L divided by 4 pi L. Okay, so this is the Debye-Huckel. So this is measured in units of the Debye mass. And actually, there was a question that we had was, this is a typical fluctuation term, and this is exactly the sort of what you get. This is the Casimir effect for a massive scalar field theory, okay? Written in these units. So we were interested in seeing what happens when you go to the next order. So this is basically the one loop calculation. What happens if you go to two loops? So beyond Debye-Huckel theory. Now, normally there's a problem with Debye-Huckel theory. If you go to two loops in Debye-Huckel theory, the pressure contains divergences, and these divergences are the fact that positive and negative ions, they can sit on top of each other and they can basically give you an infinite energy. The interesting thing is that if you're looking at a soap film, because you're working out the disjoining pressure, you're subtracting off the bulk, what you can actually show is that the bulk divergences actually cancel with the divergences in the film. So the whole theory is you're sort of like walking along a tightrope, but you manage to get across the bridge and never quite get across and never quite fall off. And so basically what you do is if you look at the two-loop correction, and what determines the deviation about Debye-Huckel theory is this thing here. This is the Debye length, which is 1 over the mass, and this is the Bajerum length. And the Bajerum length is simply the length at which the Coulomb interaction between two charged particles is equal to kBT. Okay? And what happens is if you do this calculation, you can resum it, and it looks like this. Okay? But the important thing is that, so it just changes the power law here, okay? There's a lot of work for not much. This doesn't change, but the thing is it stays attractive, okay? So you can actually do it, and this is the nice thing, if you're very, very careful doing these calculations in film-like geometries, because the divergences that are in bulk cancel with the divergences in the film.
Excuse me, this calculation, where this additional step is coming from? Is it already sitting here in this original?
The simplest form of the calculation basically is an expansion where you basically expand the cosine. So the expansion of the cosine gives you a mass term, and then you neglect the other terms. Okay, and then you expand the cosine. Well, in fact, you don't expand the cosine. That is bad. What you do is you keep the cosine, and if you decide you're going to take a phi to the 4 term, that gives you problems, okay? So what you have to do is you have to be a bit careful how you're developing the perturbation theory, and it's just that you don't want to have problems with the e to the 1 over r, okay? And the e to the 1 over r gives you something that's nice and finite. E to the minus 1 over r gives you something that's finite when you put it up in the exponential, you see, whereas if it's not in the exponential, it gives you problems. Okay, so
what happened to the saddle point pressure? You are not writing.
Well, actually, this is a symmetric soap film. This is a case where there is no charge, so you can actually do the calculation because the mean field profile is zero. Okay, and the situation is much more complicated to do this sort of calculation when you actually had a mean field profile. I mean, Rudy can do the one loop calculation. We're going to two loops then. So the problem is that you typically have a complicated. The Poisson-Boltzmann equation is a nonlinear differential equation. So even if you can find a closed form of it, you then have to put that in as a mass-dependent term. Okay, so.
But I thought that's what you were going to somehow overcome the repulsion that you have from the Poisson-Boltzmann.
Yes, but I'm not going to do the Poisson-Boltzmann equation because what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go to 1D. Okay.
Excuse me. I mean, can you say a word about how you get this? I mean, if you expand the cosine, you will get all sorts of vertices, and they will always give you exponential decay.
Yeah.
But apparently you resum them, and then this changes on this power
there. Yeah, yeah. Basically what it does is it gives you a logarithmic correction in G, which you can then decide to put in the power law. Mm-hmm. Okay. But it's... And it's just you just have to be very, very careful. You carry around the divergences and you can find that everything just goes away. So this is the nice thing about using these sorts of field theories and slab geometries is that the pathology of the theory without a hardcore cutoff is actually is as bad in the bulk as it is in the film, and everything just cancels. So this is actually sort of a universal result. I don't need any cutoff here.
Again, take note. So the log came from the two-dimensional integration. That's what I'm.
Other.
Yeah.
Well.
Yes. I mean, I'll talk about it a bit.
Yes. Ron will talk. You're going to talk about this. Yeah.
Well, not precisely not this precisely bit, but this. The overall formulation. Yeah.
Okay.
And then the third dimension acts as a cutoff. Because it became a log of
Curve. Yeah, but actually, basically, in the probes, what we do is we basically decompose the film into this direction here, which is a time-like direction, and planes, and it's like you use like Schrodinger functional equations to propagate the fields across the film. But Ronald will explain. The way in which the log emerges is sort of it's after quite a bit of algebra, and it's sort of giving it physical. I mean, okay, I couldn't, just off the top of my head give you a physical interpretation for where it comes. I mean, the important point here is that it doesn't really change the sign. You don't have sign changes. Okay.
Is G equals 4 special?
Well, this is a perturbative expansion, so G should be taken to be small.
G is the other way up. It's the general length of the deponent.
Yep. Okay. There we go. So you get this effect. Now, so the question is, okay, well, I'm doing expansions and, you know, I can't really control any of this. So in these sorts of systems, can you actually have a crossover? Can you have a non-monotonic behavior in the interaction between two soap films? Now, the point is, if I look at the problem in one dimension, okay, I can write down the Sine-Gordon field theory, and if I write it down in certain... What I'm going to do now is I'm going to have a model which is going to give me, I'm going to put a potential V of X which is going to prefer having negative ions here, okay? So the effective theory I'm going to have in one dimension looks a bit like this. Now, you have to be a bit careful because it's a 1D system. You have to talk about the endpoints. So this is the value of the field phi at zero. So this is proportional to the electrostatic field. You can show it has this form. You have, this is the endpoint, so my film is between zero and L. And I have some sort of potential here which is going to prefer putting positive ions, negative ions at the surface. So I'm now going to put exponential. So in the units that I'm using here, it's just because you're going to have d phi by dx squared. And you're going to have a term which looks like 2 mu cos phi of x dx. Okay? So this is basically in when I rescale the field phi for convenience. The Sine-Gordon field theory in one dimension, and what I'm going to have is actually, if I take a certain limit, I can model the effect of this preference to have negative charges at the surface by an additional term, which looks like exponential of lambda e to the minus I phi of zero plus e to the minus I phi of L. So actually, basically mu times e to the I psi of x plus or minus here is basically, if I look at the expect, this is an operator, is basically the density operator of the plus or minus ions. So this is just like a surface term that's telling me that I want to put negative ions on the surface, okay? So this is my model, and so the surface charging should come out self-consistently, okay? Now the nice thing about this problem is here,
who's pushing, who's pulling your envelope? Usually postulate some extra binding energy.
I've put a binding energy for negative ions at this surface.
So you don't pick that, and that drives it.
So I've got some sort of chemicals, you know, short range attraction. For, okay. And that's setting up a
and
surface.
And that's enough to everybody else to follow.
Yeah, that's right. So this term, I mean, basically you take a region of a surface.
No, this is fine. Okay. I mean, sometimes what you'll do is do it on both sides, but this is fine.
Yeah, this is so. In principle, I could have given a, you know, I'm just breaking the symmetry between positive and negative ions with this term, okay?
What happens to charge neutrality?
It's imposed by, it's still here.
The salt.
Because it's in contact with the bulk.
The salt takes care of it.
Yeah, the salt comes in, you see, the bulk comes in.
Well, okay. What happens to the reality of that theory? Because if I expand it, I will have complex terms.
Ah, yes, this is true.
Which means you don't have charge neutrality.
Well, no, you do have charge neutrality because actually the fact that there's an integration over d phi zero here actually imposes charge neutrality. If I expand everything in terms of the Fourier series, you can show that. So the charge, because actually there's a way of defining this theory using Brownian motion, okay? So you do the path integral rigorously, and actually you can write down basically the Coulomb interaction is basically qi qj mod of xi minus xj. Okay? And what you do is you basically, if you have charge neutrality, you can see if I write xi minus xj is equal to twice the minimum. So I can write this as equal to xi plus xj minus twice the minimum of xi xj. This is a correlation function for Brownian motion. If there's charge neutrality, the first terms go away. So I can write the whole path integral in terms of a Brownian motion starting at zero and going to L. It's not constrained to L, but it's constrained to start at zero. Now, if you impose electron neutrality in the problem, it basically means that you integrate over the starting point of the Brownian motion. And so that basically means that that's why this integral here gives you neutrality. So this is an important point. Okay? So now, but this is quantum mechanics, and so basically, the bulk theory of the one-dimensional Coulomb gas was solved by Leonard in 1962, and actually it was more or less the same sort of period where, you know, Feynman was really developing path integrals, and Sam Edwards noticed that you could solve this problem using path integrals. Okay, and so he wrote to Leonard and he said, I can get, but the Leonard paper is actually a tour de force of mathematical physics, because he does it without using recursion relations, for the which is what Ali basically rediscovered, okay, which was very good. And so this was done in a non-path integral way, and then there was a paper by Edwards and Leonard in 1963. So Sam Edwards basically saw that you could solve these problems using path integrals, and he wrote up his notes, he sent them to Leonard, and then Leonard apparently sent him a paper all written up with theorem proof, etc. And apparently Rudolf Pyle said to Sam, why have you looked at this problem? There's nothing interesting in one dimension. Okay, so there you go. So, but anyway, but the nice thing about it is that you can find out exactly what's happening. So, obviously, if you're interested in the, if I'm interested in computing this partition function now, I can write z is equal to, now this is a question, 1 over 2 pi, the integral between 0 and 2 pi, deep psi 0, and I can use, so this is basically just the propagator, this path integral is a propagator, and I can think of it as acting on the end point here, as this being a source term, so I can take the phi 0, this term here, and put it on the left, so I'm going to get e to the lambda, e to the convention, I've taken them to be minus I psi 0, and then I can put a Hamiltonian operator here, and then I just act on this term here. Okay? And where this Hamiltonian here is just equal to minus e squared beta over 2, d2 by d psi 0 squared minus 2 mu cos psi 0. Okay? Now the thing is, this looks like a really horrible thing, because it's true that you look at this and you think, it would have been much nicer if I had have decided to put the positive ions on the other side, I would have had a plus sign here, you see, I would have got something. But the fact that you'll see there's a miracle how these complex terms behave. Okay, so let's look at the bulk properties. Now, of course, if you give a quantum mechanics course on solid state physics, then of course you know all about these things, okay? So basically, at large L, if I forget about the surface terms, basically I'm going to find log Z over L, so as L goes to infinity, is equal to basically minus E0, where E0 is the lowest energy of this Hamiltonian, okay? And actually, the sort of eigenvalues of the Mathieu functions, because of their importance, obviously have been studied a lot, and you can play around with things, and for example, you can write the high temperature bulk pressure okay, which is equal to beta, so beta P bulk. So I just, it's just basically given by, I can read it off from the asymptotics of this. So you basically find the equivalent of the Debye-Huckel theory for the one-dimensional gas, find something like that. Okay, work out these terms. So you can see that you get the classical result for your, so rho is basically the sum of, rho is the density of salt and, you know, if you put NaCl, it's the density of the NaCl that you're putting together. So there are no surprises there. There's a really neat thing in this calculation. It's if I go to low temperature, then I look at the bulk pressure, and this is a really neat result. This is equal to the first term is a half rho plus 7 over 8, and you can work out the other terms, you have rho beta e squared. Plus other terms here, it was 23 over 288. Okay, so the good thing about this, so this is the ideal gas, but for half the density. And this is because your ions pair up. Okay, so this is the dimerization effect. Okay, so at low temperatures, this is the formation of cation anion pairs. Okay, so let's go back to...
Let's say they all pair up. I still have the unpaired guys who are neutralizing my surface.
Which is the bulk.
This is the bulk. I'm not reading the text. So this is the bulk. I mean, I just wanted to mention this result here. because I mean, not many people know about this paper. I think this, you know, this is something that this would be like the holy grail if you could sort of somehow get the dimerization sorted out, the pairing up sorted out into in 3D systems. That would be neat. Okay, so that comes out.
Since I got it wrong once, I'll ask you the next question. So there's some kind of an assumption about not letting Coulomb go to infinity or something. Is that sort of built in as a limit?
You mean it's short distances?
Yeah.
It doesn't have any singularities. It's equal to zero because it's mod x minus x, right? Uh-huh. So there's no problems there, you see. Okay.
Can you discuss
your units? Your units of density have some statement about how strong the pairing energy is. I'm missing why that's not here.
I don't know what.
If I have two really fat guys, they're not going to have exactly the same. Assuming it's a Coulomb interaction between their centers.
This is one dimensional.
You don't mean just two points in the one direction.
No.
You really mean these?
Yeah, the sheets. Yeah, these are the sheets. If you want to, in fact, you know, because so you could actually think. Sheets. Okay. So sorry, Joe.
No, the one dimensional free field in 1D is like a final path integral.
Yes.
And usually one says that just the spectrum of the Schrödinger equation is discrete, and the lowest eigenvalue is separated from the others. The thermodynamic limit you have what you want.
Yes.
But here the spectrum, I think, is continuous.
No, there's a gap.
There is a gap.
Yeah, there's a gap.
But you have to point out that this is a periodic system. And so it's only an even odd. It's either the ones at the top of the band or the ones at the bottom of the band.
Just one step.
Yes.
So the important thing.
It looks like a block wave.
It's the block wave at the top of the band, at the bottom of the band, because it has to be symmetrical. It's because it's got a symmetry. Yeah, right, in the
there are many, many block waves. Starting positive. The band is just.
The field phi is on 0.2 pi. So
but they're not symmetric on the lattice space.
Perhaps in the language of solid state physics, this is a surface state.
I wouldn't.
No, it's just the bottom of the band.
I know what the band means, that there is a continuum starting from the bottom going on the way up.
Yeah, you just take the one.
The gap is
Yeah.
I mean, as far as this quantum mechanics here is just defined on, you know, this quantum mechanics is defined on 0.2 pi, so there are no. This lower interval here is restricted. And if you look at the, you know, there is clearly a gap when you look at this operator on 0.2 pi.
Yes. It's a finite system, I think that's important.
Yeah. Finite system.
Yeah. Okay. So let's see how the fluctuation introduced. So the interesting thing is when you get changes of signs in fluctuation induced interactions. Okay. Now let me write down the disjoining pressure. Okay. The pressure of the film, I can write it as minus beta times Cn squared, okay? Actually, I'll write the disjoining pressure. Okay, I can do a bit of algebra, and I can write it as En minus E0. There's a minus E0 here because I've subtracted off the bulk pressure. E to the minus L times En divided by the sum over Cn squared E to the minus Ln. Okay, so this is the partition function. This is because I've taken the derivative with respect to L. Okay, so this is the form of the disjoining pressure, the pressure of the film with the bulk pressure taken out. Now let's have a look. So these Cn squared terms, they were clearly disturbing because they're related to the coefficients, the sort of matrix element between this source term here and the eigenfunctions of the Mathieu equation. So basically, Cn is equal to. So if I write the eigenfunction of my Mathieu equation Cn. These coefficients Cn are basically 1 over 2 pi chi n of phi e to the lambda e to the minus I phi. Right? Now the point is that if you look at the symmetry of the Mathieu functions, if you think about taking the point pi as the central part, they're actually symmetric about 0 and 2 pi, if you, they're actually symmetric about pi if you look at the even functions. So basically Cn is actually purely real for n even, and Cn is purely imaginary for n odd. Okay? So basically what you find here is, because the first, now at large, sorry, this, so at large separations, what you're basically going to find is the term that's going to dominate here will be a term of minus, so for L large, we find is equal to beta Cn squared, the modulus of Cn squared times E n minus E0 times E to the minus L times E minus E0, E1 minus E0 over C0 squared, which is positive, okay? So basically what you find is, if you look at the coefficients here, you basically find that the odd wave functions give you a repulsive interaction, and the even wave functions give you an attractive interaction. But you didn't see the attractive interaction due to the dominant thermodynamic wave function, because you've subtracted it off because it's the bulk pressure. So you can see that you get, so you can get this problem of sign change, and it comes because of the way in which the field theory is interacting with the boundaries. Okay, so these are boundary terms. So it's basically the physics is being controlled by the overlap of these wave functions with the source terms that you put in the boundary. Now, obviously, if I decided to put make a situation that was symmetrical for positive and negative ions, and decide to put one surface with the lambda for the plus and the other with the lambda for the minuses, then when I looked at my matrix coefficients here, you see, I would have put a plus here, and then all of my Cn squareds would have been real, and I would have always found an attractive interaction, okay? So oppositely charged, or surfaces with thermodynamic mechanisms that will give them symmetric opposite charges will tend to attract. But in this case here, you see, so in fact, the whole business about worrying about things being real or imaginary in the field theory is actually what gives you the richness of being able to have a change in sign in the effective interaction between the two surfaces. And I won't sort of, because I decided to do it on the blackboard, but you know, basically if you work out the disjoining pressure, you can get things that do this, and you know, you can even have two bumps in it, okay? So it just shows that, so this is a mechanism, okay, the system isn't particularly realistic, but you can sort of knock everything down in a very rigorous way. So you can say, with this sort of surface interaction term, you can get effective interactions, which are fluctuation-induced because they are beyond mean field theory, okay? I'm taking into account all of the fluctuation effects here, and it can give these changes of sign. So I should stop there, because I was supposed to talk for half an hour.
When we were kids, we learned this thing about silk films and like thin, with all these different colors. But the idea always was that at very long distances, there'd be kind of a van der Waals force or something, because that was the power law, the longest thing that's pushing them together. And then they would run into electrostatic things, and then they'd collapse for some reason, because there'd be a stronger van der Waals. Again, it seems to sort of go on a different way. What's that initial rise then? What should we be thinking about that? Is that just plain old fashioned?
Well, this is basically a regime where the surface charge of the film is basically the two surface charges are giving you an effective, because they have the same sign, they're right, giving you effective repulsive interaction.
Fair enough, but they also tell you that that's exponentially screened, and the van der Waals attraction is usually a power law that wins. So at least that's the way they taught it to us.
It
should have been that it got pushed together, and then it had trouble because it reached.
Right.
So what's upsy downsy here? I don't.
Yeah. Okay. No. I think the thing is, if the surface charge is sufficiently strong, then I mean, this sort of theory, at least the mean field theory, applies pretty well for soap films that are about 40 angstroms. And so you do have this regime where the electrostatic interactions are dominating, because presumably the Debye length.
For sure. But I thought it was the other way, that the very longest one was a power law.
Yes, it would be.
And that would be sort of
Well, actually, exactly. But I said, if you look at the data fittings,
yeah.
when you do the mean field theory for the surface charge regularization, the Van der Waals, the long-term Van der Waals, if you look at the very, very long, long distance of the disjoining pressure, actually, you do need that term to explain what happens at very long distances. So this is an intermediate regime where you bring the surfaces close enough, and you then start seeing this.
Before that, out here about 2 feet this way, it would have been a track coming up into that region.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, yeah, I'm showing. Yeah, okay. But the thing is, you don't. When you do your experiment, you never see that issue because you don't put a. Yeah, you don't put negative. You don't apply negative pressure. But it would be interesting.
When you talk about one dimensional Coulomb gas, are you referring to the original physical system, just reduce the one dimension? Or are you talking about a dual representation of the Sine-Gordon field theory, which is through the lens transformation, also gives you one-dimensional Coulomb gas?
I'm saying that. Imagine. I'm saying that we can't solve the 3D problem.
No, I understand.
Yeah. That. I'm just. So this comes from electrostatics. The electrostatic model I have gives me a Sine-Gordon field theory. Mm-hmm. There's no more to it than that.
So the Coulomb gas is just reduced to one dimension, the original system, right?
Yes, exactly. What I'm saying is, take a physical model, or if you want to think in three dimension, I take sheets of charge which are interacting, or point particles interacting in one dimension. And so the Sine-Gordon field that you write down is independent, you know, it basically has the same form independent dimension, but then it depends on the kinetic operator, then gives you the. So I'm just looking at the one dimensional model.
Right. Sine-Gordon field theory has kinks for the main walls. Are there counterparts to them in the original system?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to say because basically you just work everything out here and there doesn't seem to be, I suppose you might want to interpret things in terms of kinks or whatever, but I don't see. Because you don't want to be looking at mean field theory or anything like that. You don't want to be looking at classical solutions. So, we're just really solving the theory completely here because it's quantum mechanics, and so there's no need to.
It's only on 0 to 2 pi, right? Yeah. If you're thinking on, obviously, you've got a corrugated surface and you can start in this well and you can click away over there, but this doesn't have that because it's only on 0 to 2 pi. That imposes the discreteness of the spectrum because these integrals then have to be periodic, the kinds of periodic.
And that's why this charge conservation is important.
Yeah,
and the fact of charge neutrality is important.
So I think that
you're just saying it's always forbidden, right?
I think it's not. I think this is trivial in that sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm worried about convexity. If you are plotting a function there that has derivatives and second derivatives all over the place, and as long as I evaluate the partition function of a realistic system, there's thermodynamics and various theorems for
B. Yes. So in terms of thermodynamics.
Yeah, but if you calculate the partition function correctly, you never get to the situation where you have to construct Maxwell's equation. It'll automatically come up. So unless you are calculating partition function that is not realistic, you're subtracting some things that I don't see.
I'm taking off the bulk pressure in this computation.
Would be. So that's
just the bulk pressure. Yes, the bulk is subtracting off the bulk pressure.
But then that would imply that the bulk pressure as a function of that variable that you have plotted has compensating dependence.
I think we have two bumps, don't we?
If you try hard, you might get two bumps. But I mean, normally, I think the one bump is more generic. And the total pressure is always positive. But because you're subtracting off the bulk pressure, there's a behavior with respect to that. I mean, the actual pressure itself is a positive quantity.
The thing is, it depends what ensemble. It depends what the ensemble you're using is. Okay. Yeah.
So then the question is that something that is ever physically observable?
Yes.
This
is seen in the experiments. Okay. You see something like this occurring in the experiments. There is some sort of regime here which is thermic,
I have no problem with the experiment. I'm asking if one were to compute For your problem, you say that your total pressure obeys appropriate convexity relation. And so somehow you've done then a subtraction of something at infinity. But that may not give you the thing that is relevant to the experiment. That's what I'm not sure. Because I can always take thermodynamic quantities and subtract of something, and then the remainder can do strange things. But
yeah, well, I think that, what I'm basically I'm computing the contribution to the pressure from electrostatic forces. And if I do the same, if I were to do the same thing in mean field theory and add on van der Waals forces, then I would get exactly the same sort of curve. So I don't really understand.
From thermodynamics, there should be a relation between this excess pressure and some other quantity.
Milan wants to say is, I mean, if you compute really a partition function take with thermodynamic limit, you are guaranteed to have convexity. Now you subtract something, and apparently this is some sort of a analog of a finite thing. But I mean, if this is a meaningful thermodynamic potential describing the experimental situation, then it should have. It should be flat there because it should have the convexity properties. And apparently, even though you subtracted something, but you find
I think it depends because it basically means that okay, that this region here is thermodynamically.
But you see, usually.
I mean, if I were to put an E to the minus, if I were to do it in a constant pressure ensemble. Then I wouldn't see this effect. If I put in a term e to the minus pl, then this would go away.
But the point is that exact calculations of partition functions in the thermodynamic limit know all of these subtleties and avoid, and they themselves make those things. And if I don't see that in a supposedly exact calculation, I start questioning the reality of the Hamiltonian or things that were evaluated.
I mean, basically, I mean, all I see is I'm computing a thermodynamic force between two surfaces, and you get this sort of effective force from by adding on van der Waals forces. So I don't really.
That's an approximate treatment. I agree that there are lots of the van der Waals theory is an approximate treatment will give you that loop, but if you calculate the partition function of infinitely long-range interacting systems, it automatically takes care of that loop.
Usually you get this, you find a violation of convexity because one neglects states which are not homogeneous. But in your calculation, you're really doing it in exact calculation.
Absolutely, everything is in there.
It should be everything.
Absolutely. Now, perhaps there could be issues related to the fact that, despite the fact the interaction is screened, that the underlying interaction is a very long-range interaction. So that could.
I'm not sure about that. I guess that brings me back to my original question: that the partition function that you are writing, I mean, is that really what one should be writing or not?
What you're trying to say is you have a bulk reservoir with a small soap film which it feeds. Now, the assumption is the chemical potential that controls inside the soap film is the same as the chemical potential in the bulk. That's mu.
Yeah.
Then you get charge regulation because those charges just appear on the surfaces. So, and then you're squeezing this. So you're applying a certain, you're doing thermodynamically what you normally do. You're saying, what's the energy of this? How does it change? So I think the assumption is in the fact the chemical potential is the same.
Yeah, but if the chemical potential is such that the system suddenly wants to do this, why do you see that range in between that is inherently unstable? Why doesn't it suck in or send out enough salt molecules that it can bridge that gap? If it is at a constant chemical potential, where that exchange is allowed.
Because this potential looks like effective potential for first.
But there is also. I can argue that in a 3D film, this is something that I thought about one time, that you can imagine that the surface modes obey some surface 2D field theory And then there's the roughening. There's the low frequency modes undergo instability and it forms little bubbles in the surface, 2D bubbles, which actually can then propagate. And the 2D bubble is actually a thinning of the surface. So there's suddenly a fluctuation of the surfaces can stick together. Certainly this effect won't happen unless you've got a potential in the surface that sticks charges there. I mean, I agree that the ensemble that you take for all of these things, I mean, I should mention it tomorrow, if you ask the same question, you'll get the same answer, which is fine. The ensemble that you discuss has to be very carefully.
So I'm just curious, who conducted an experiment on these?
So actually the experiments that I worked on were conducted, the data that I looked at were conducted at Saclay in the group of Jean-Jacques Benetat. These experiments were, the experimental work was done in about 97 or something like that. 1997.
Okay, so it was before the advent of the AFM. So how did they measure that absolute distance? How did they know, like, you have 60 angstrom from?
By X-ray reflectivity.
X-ray spectrum.
So there's a single time.
Yeah.
Because we've done a lot of measurements of charge.
It means that stability.
And horizontal films as well.
So we've done a lot of measurements on charge, multi-layers, and everything looks suitably boring until you have big ions and state distortion.
Actually, there was Daniel Vaughan's group in Paris did experiments, and they claimed that their results they could fit more or less with the Van der Waals and the mean field theory. They were making optical measurements. I guess that's not a difference. The biggest difference I can think of between the two systems is that in Saclay the films they're looking at are huge. The very big films, I mean, whereas the films that, so I don't know if there was some effect related. So, I mean, so the experimental issue is perhaps not completely clear as to whether or not, because depending on who you talk to, the mean field theory plus, non-zero frequency Van der Waals interactions is enough to explain.
Remind me
to
show you some data.
Okay.
More questions, more comments, more food, chocolate. Did you guys finally finish the chocolate? I mean, you realize how many times I've passed chocolate around here and it doesn't get done. This is not bad. It wouldn't have made one pass.
What kind of people are we? This is the first, and the first time the chocolate's been finished, I'm talking.
Go for it. Is there any left?
Good talk anyway.